Hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is March 23rd, 2023. A quorum is present. The first item on the agenda is the minutes. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 21st, 2023?
So moved.
Representative Niska, thank you, moves approval of the minutes for March 21st, 2023. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Chairbacker Finn, you have the first item on the agenda, House File 1202. Where are we sending this? Would you like to move to recommend that House File 1202 be re-referred back to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my motion.
Thank you, Chairbacker Finn. And Chairbacker Finn, I do see there is an amendment. Would you like to move the A9 amendment and explain that amendment?
Yep. So the A9 has two things in it. One is something that we actually put on in a previous committee stop, but it didn't get engrossed properly, so we're just fixing that here. So it was something that was fully vetted in that committee. And then the other provisions are at the request of the State Bar Association, just to clarify some of the things surrounding real estate transactions.
Members, any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment is accepted. Chairbacker Finn, please present House File 1202 as amended.
Yeah, so House File 1202 is sort of like a mini omnibus chronic wasting disease bill. For folks who haven't, who are new to the legislature, chronic wasting disease is a prion-based disease. So a prion is a misfolded protein similar to mad cow disease. So we have been debating this issue my whole time in office, and the same way that Representative Kraft probably didn't mean to be the excavation guy, I didn't run for office to be the CWD person, but that's sort of how it's ended up. I am a deer hunter myself, and it's pretty nerdy and pretty complicated, and here we are still dealing with it today. So chronic wasting disease is a always fatal disease for deer, and it has spread over the years as we have honestly as a state failed to take stronger action to slow its spread. This bill, I'm not going to walk through the entire bill. I'm just going to point out the provisions that are in the jurisdiction of our committee here. So there is a section one has to do with animal premises data, just making that premises data public so folks know where these facilities are. If you're purchasing property, if you're a deer hunter, you know that we know where these properties are located. There also is a liability section in section seven, that's on page five. That would allow some liability if someone has, so we had an incident in Beltrami County where someone was unlawfully disposing of infected carcasses of dead deer from their private facility on public land. We as the taxpayers paid to clean that up, and so we're making sure that we're holding folks accountable when we have bad actors. So those are the main provisions that are before this committee. And with that, I think there are a couple testifiers, and then happy to take questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Darren Lee, please come down to the testifiers table. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Darren Lee with Flaherty and Hood, representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association today. An association that has over 11,000 members statewide, created by hunters and for hunters. For the past 40 years, the MDHA has been building a hunting and conservation legacy through habitat, education, and advocacy. We want to express our gratitude to Chair Becker Finn for carrying HF 1202 and express our support specifically for the provision on lines 2.15 through 2.26. We believe this change would make it clear that a hunter who kills and possesses an escaped farm cervidae would not be liable to the owner for the animal. You can imagine circumstances where a hunter may encounter such an animal and have no idea that it may be an escaped cervidae. We also appreciate that this section places all liability on the owner for the escaped animal with respect to proper disposal of the animal in the event that it tests positive for CWD, as well as any additional associated costs. Thank you, Chair Beckerfin and members of the committee, for your consideration of this bill, and we will continue to be a resource as needed as this bill moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you. I see we do have two folks signed up for public testimony. Brenda Hartkoff. Good morning. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Brenda Hartkoff from Splendid Ridge Elk Farm in Howard Lake, Minnesota, where my husband and I have raised elk for 30 years. We have CWD monitored our animals since 1998, and we've never missed a test. However, these proposed changes make it not feasible for us to continue raising elk in Minnesota. Madam Chair, Section 1, making my personal location data available to the public. As a wife, mother, and grandmother, I cannot live in fear of my family members being personally harmed, becoming a victim of vandalism, or having someone take it upon themselves to dispatch my herd. Madam Chair, Section 6, Subdivision 11-7, recording with the county or registrar of titles CWD details. While a farm would be required to report a CWD detection on their title, a private landowner does not have to report detections of free-ranging CWD-positive deer on their title. Subdivision 11-6 covers the necessary disclosure details. Subdivision 11-7 rises to the level of discrimination. Madam Chair, Section 7, Subdivision 11-A, holding a herd owner liable in civil action to a person injured by the sale of farm servidae. Because incubation time can be anywhere from 6 months to 3 years, how would a court determine where the infection began? Madam Chair, we would recommend adding language to line 510 after the word servidae, insert, known to be exposed or infected. I would please ask you provide the industry the courtesy to talk through the bill together. Thank you.
Thank you. Tim Spreck. Good morning. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is, Tim Spreck. I'm here speaking for the Minnesota Deer Farmers Association. Mr. Chair, with specific regard to the items within the jurisdiction of this bill, let's go to Section 1 under animal premises data. What this does is it really violates a servidae farmer's right to privacy. It makes them unique among all livestock producers. This is not done anywhere in the industry and really places a burden upon these farmers because it makes them potential targets for vandalism and theft. Vandalism and theft have happened numerous times on deer farms over the years, and to provide the unscrupulous in the world this additional information gives them a track to perpetrate these crimes against the deer farmers. It's just bad policy. Under Section 7, liability, this makes the herd owners liable for sale of a CWD-positive animal. And as Ms. Hartkoff just mentioned, owners may not know that the animal is infected at the time of sale, so in good faith, they potentially could sell an animal that could become infected later, and also additionally, we don't know when that animal was infected. There's no ending clause on this particular provision, so I sold an animal to anyone on this committee. A year, 2 years from now, it could be positive through a possibly any other potential vector, but I would still be liable. If this language is to work, it needs to be cleaned up, and adding known infected is a great way to go about doing that. Under the same section, under letter B, unlawful to dispose infected servidae. Mr. Chair, this is something that the Deer Farmers Association have been talking about ever since that farm was sited in Beltrami County. This was an illegal act. It's always been illegal. It always will be illegal. Making it more illegal is not going to do anybody any good. What we need to do is come out very strongly, and our organization has done so. Anyone who does anything illegal in terms of dumping infected animals needs to be held to full account, and we fully support that.
Thank you, Mr. Go ahead.
Moving down to Section 6, quickly with the county recorder. This is really not needed. Current disclosure law already takes care of this. In the event that you sell a property, you must disclose any material defects on the property. This would be covered under current law. So what we do if we move forward with this, we create an additional cloud or an encumbrance upon the title of this property, which is challenging to get rid of. We do understand and appreciate the amendment that was offered, but the problems we have with the language of the amendment is that how would removal of this encumbrance be accomplished? Is there a legal proceeding required? And the current disclosure system is actually the best for taking care of it, so no change is necessary. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you. There are no other public members signed up for testimony, but are there any other individuals in the public that would like to testify? Seeing none, members will have discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. I'm just interested in hearing kind of the, because this is an issue that I don't, you know, I'm not really all that familiar with, but why would we share this private information? What's the value in that? It seems like it's shaming them and making them vulnerable to, as some of the testifiers said, you know, vandalism or other.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. No, the purpose is not to shame anyone. The purpose is in the same way that we have other data that's public is so that we're just being clear about where these facilities are located. We know with the number of facilities that have popped off with positives that as soon as that happens, the area around where those positives are happening are now at much higher risk for the wild deer in that vicinity to also be positive from, you know, fence, you know, nose-to-nose contact, escapes, those kinds of things. And what we have now is a situation where you might, like, let's say you have saved up your whole life to buy a cabin, a hunting cabin in northern Minnesota. And you finally find a property, you're going to, you get a pretty good deal. You go buy that property, you find out it's next door to a deer farm. You're now at higher risk that that property you just bought to go deer hunting is now maybe useless to you, and you're at higher risk that you're going to end up with CWD within, you know, just a couple miles or next door to your property. We know when we had, you know, I've talked to people who own property in Crow Wing County where there were escaped deer that tested positive and then wild deer were found to be positive. We know in Beltrami County, I've talked to some of those neighboring landowners who had no idea that they had purchased property that was next to this. The same way you'd want to know if there was a polluter or some other kind of high-risk business. So that's the idea with that, is making sure that the public is aware of where these facilities are located. If you've ever tried to figure out where they're located, good luck.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot of you addressed, and some of the testifiers did too, about deer escaping from these farms, and it seems like, do we already have this double fencing in the state of Minnesota, or that's something new, and do other states do that?
Madam Chair.
Not really within the jurisdiction of this committee, so I've been trying to keep the focus on that, but no, it's not currently required in Minnesota.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to get to the liability. If the deer escapes, and in this bill, there's liability for that. And so if someone at a deer farm has an animal that tests positive, this addresses what they must do. What if you are that person that saved up for the cabin in northern Minnesota, you're just a private landowner, and you find an animal that you think, or let's say you test it, is it the same liability that person has? I'm just trying to distinguish between an animal that is on a deer farm and an animal that isn't, but it's found on a premises.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, and I think you actually bring up the heart of this problem, which is that we have the same species that some people are treating like a domesticated farmed animal, and that is actually a protected natural resource for hunters and Minnesotans. So, I mean, if you're the person who bought a hunting cabin, it would have been during the deer season as you're lawfully hunting. You may or may not have that tested depending upon what area of the state you're in. It's really a different situation than if you are choosing to import animals and really have, you know, you're making money off of it. I mean, that's part of the difference, as well as we also have a, you know, constitutional right to hunt and to take game in Minnesota. And so it's sort of a different situation if you're a hunter lawfully hunting during the season versus somebody who's, you know, moving animals back and forth, selling animals. It's just a different situation, and that's why the liability would be different.
Reverend Scott, do you have one more follow-up? There are a couple more members on that.
Sure. I just want to conclude. I don't know a lot about this topic, but it was said that, you know, that Minnesota hasn't done enough. It seems like I hear about this issue a lot, and there's a lot of research and different things going on, and it seems like this will make our state an outlier for these folks. It seems like an attempt just to get rid of them altogether, and that concerns me. So thank you for the question.
Representative Johnson.
I'm Chair Frazier, Chair Becker Finn. I appreciate what you're doing here. It's a lot of work. This is an issue that I've been watching very closely ever since I've been down here. In my area, we have a couple of these facilities. Fortunately, last I heard, had not had the CWD issue. But I'm going to focus more on southeastern Minnesota, which is a large, which has had quite a few of these incidents occur. Minnesota has been doing a lot to try to curb CWD over the past number of years. Unfortunately, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois is doing nothing. They're just letting it run its course. Now, deer, they move a lot. In fact, Minnesota doesn't have any mule deer, but there's times that mule deer are taken in Minnesota, so they've come from out west. Deer don't know state boundaries. At times, they can move 100, 200 miles just roaming. So I'm just wondering, with all this we're doing, when the surrounding states around us are not doing anything, how is this going to help?
Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair Frazier. And you're right, we can't control what people do in other states, but I strongly believe that we can take steps that will slow down this disease spreading within our state. We have documented cases. It's actually overwhelming when you look at the charts of, well, this one sold to here, and then this one got sold to here, and then this one was moved here, and you can see how the CWD spreads. So we have control of slowing down the spread of those things, and that's the goal here.
Representative Johnson.
Chair, Representative Chair Becker Finn, I appreciate what you do. And the other issue I have is having the careful how we deal with the escaping deer. So I've actually had it in my community where I had to, I took the call as a law enforcement officer, where people were against deer farming and elk farming. And they actually went and cut the fences and released the animals. If that happens, and it happens to be, find out later that one of them happened to have CWD, is that landowner going to be responsible, or the person, if they catch the person that let that animal go by cutting the fence, is that person going to be responsible?
Chair Becker Finn.
No.
Representative Grosso, you're next.
Okay. There was an awkward pause there for.
Well, I know. I think she was so succinct in answering that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the author. Where do you have your? Can you cite your resources I mean, where is your information coming from?
Chairbacker Finn, I'm not sure. Chairbacker Finn.
I mean, I don't even know where to start. I can certainly, if I would have known you were going to ask for that, I could have brought you some resources. But I mean, scientists, the U of M is doing some incredible research. Both there's a prion center and the work of Dr. Osterholm's group. There's been a lot of good science and research that actually we as a legislature have helped fund some of that good research. So, I mean, it's science-based.
Follow-up, Representative Grosso.
Been a lot of things science-based in the past few years that have really been kind of, yeah. You have arguments on both sides. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And as far as the research goes, it's really, they're still a long way off from finding out how this stuff really goes about spreading, how it, and so on. Are you aware that there are some deer, and there are a lot of deer, that have an immunity to this disease?
Chairbacker Finn, is that the question?
Yes.
Chairbacker Finn.
Yeah, sorry, Mr. Chair. I was trying to find there recently was a letter from SIDRAP and the folks at the U of M addressing that. So I was going to see if I could find it. I mean,
addressing which one? I'm sorry.
Your question about the genetic. I mean, sure, there's different genetics in deer, but I think it is a dangerous game that we're playing. If I know there are folks out there who are suggesting that they are going to pull off some, you know, mad scientist stuff and magically breed this disease out of deer and then put captive deer somehow get those genetics out into the wild deer herd. And I oppose that. I don't think that we know for sure that that would even work. And I think anytime we are, it's just a dangerous game for us to think that we should be impacting the genetics of a wild species.
Representative Gross, we've got a couple other members on the list.
Sure, I'll be quick.
Let him.
I'll be quick.
Quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm curious as to why isn't the DNR or the U, why aren't they using these deer farms where they find the infected, where they find an infected animal? Why aren't they using those as a resource to do their studies? And instead of putting the animals down, why aren't they checking to see which animals might have an immunity, which animals...
Representative Grosso, I don't think that's in the jurisdiction of this committee.
And Mr. Chair, this is going back to the Environment Committee.
All right.
I mean, those are some of the things I'd ask you to look at. One more thing
Representative Grosso, no, I gave you the one more. I'm going to move on because we do have other members and I don't want to get behind here. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Frazier and Representative Becker Finn, for your bill. I was in Environment. In Environment, we had a whole presentation on chronic wasting disease. I think it's, if you're interested in the research and the science, I mean, we got a very deep dive into the research and the science and the way that everybody is working together. But one of the things that I think we need to recognize in this committee is that this is a really complicated problem. We have really complicated problems sometimes where we have to weigh the public interest against the private interest, and we have to make decisions. We have to make decisions about the future and how we want the future state of Minnesota to operate and what we want our state to look like. And the state of Minnesota has a constitutional protection for deer hunting. We can't ignore the constitutional protections that we have. We also have treaty rights, the highest law of the land, that protect deer. And we need to act in a way that recognizes the short term and the long term. And I would just like to hear a little bit, maybe if you could, about what happens if we don't take action now on chronic wasting disease. And I do think this is germane because we were talking about data and we were talking about the public release of data, that's a public interest, public good. And if we don't take these hard decisions now, what happens to our constitutional and treaty-based obligations?
Chair Breckenfeld.
Yeah, thank you for that question. And, you know, the thing I think is important, so in Article 13, Section 12, hunting and fishing and the taking of game and fish are a valued part of our heritage and shall forever be preserved for the people and shall be managed by law and regulation for the public good. That is what our current state constitution says. And so I think the important thing that I had not touched on is that it is across the board the advisement is that you not eat deer that are infected with CWD, the same way that mad cow disease had an impact on humans from eating infected meat. The same thing is true. There are very real risks to humans by eating infected meat. So if your right as a native person, if your treaty right to be able to continue to take game does not include the ability to eat that game, then that right is useless. And I honestly think that if we don't do more, we are setting ourselves up for a constitutional challenge. I would not be surprised if we as a state are sued either by a hunter under this part of the Constitution or a tribal member who has been negatively impacted. So, I mean, there's very real consequences and the ability for folks, many of us in rural Minnesota, to feed our families if we do not protect the wild deer herd.
Rep. Pink, any follow-up? Representative Minsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke and Chair Becker-Finn, for that important discussion about our Constitution. I agree that we need to follow the Constitution. I think we'll talk more about that this afternoon, but I wanted to ask about the liability provision specifically. And at first, I wanted to understand what the sort of background rule is right now or what legal principles would apply right now in that situation of a herd owner selling or disposing of deer with a CWD. Would it be a negligence kind of standard, a standard of care, or would it be a nuisance case under current law? I'm just trying to understand how we're changing the legal landscape with this liability provision.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Frazier. You know, I think right now everyone's just kind of like, oh, bummer. And nobody's really taking responsibility for their role in the movement of the disease. So that's part of what we're trying to address. I don't know that, to my knowledge, I don't know that anyone's tried to bring a suit. You know, I'm not privy to whatever the private agreements are between buyers and sellers.
Representative Miska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Chair Becker-Finn. Is it fair to say, to characterize this as changing from what would probably be a negligent standard to a strict liability standard for sale of deer with CWD that maybe the seller didn't even know or didn't necessarily even do anything negligent in the sale of that deer?
Chair Becker-Finn.
I don't know that I would say that it would be, sorry, Mr. Chair. I don't know that I would describe it that way. I mean, we're not calling it strict liability.
Representative, one more follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Becker-Finn. I think it is. I think it's creating a strict liability standard. The new language says a herd owner is liable under certain circumstances. There's no reference to any standard of care. There's no reference to any state of mind or scienter requirement. And so I think what we're doing is we're taking a situation from, you know, a pet bite or a situation to you own a tiger that gets out and harms someone and you're held strictly liable. So I think the message that we're sending, and maybe this is the message that you intend to send to deer farmers, is that that they're like the lion or tiger owner that's going to be held strictly liable regardless of what the standard of care is. So I think that liability provision maybe could use a little bit of adjusting to, like one of the testifiers suggested, that put some sort of state of mind or standard of care in there instead of a strict liability standard.
Thank you. Chair Becker-Finn, would you like to?
Yeah, I just want to clarify. I'm not trying to tell people who sell deer urine that they are tiger owners. That's not what's happening here.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. I will say, just as a point of privilege, that we are trying to address and protect the Constitution protected right here, being able to hunt deer safely in our state. And we've got tons of case law to deal with, and smart judges, too, to deal with cases that will come before them. So I'm not terribly concerned about that. Seeing no further questions, Chair Becker-Finn, would you like to give your closing statements?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Frazier. And I just want to correct the record. There was comment about not having the courtesy of discussing the bill. I've been discussing this bill with folks who, on both sides of the issue for, I've been discussing these issues since 2017. So that will continue. I also, you know, some of the discussion around the liability. This is a third committee stop. This is the first time anyone suggested any changes. Certainly, conversations will continue, and that's why we're sending it back to the Environment Committee. At the end of the day, this is about putting the rights of our 500,000 plus deer hunters, making sure that their rights are really held up. So would renew my motion to move House File 1202 as amended to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee.
Chairbreaker Finn renews the motion to recommend that House File 1202 as amended be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
All right, next up we've got Representative Cha. Welcome to the committee. So I will move House File 2718 be re-referred back to the Ag Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Cha, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Thanks for having me. Let's see, where do I start? Chair Bikefin and committee members, this bill before you is HF 2718. This bill will establish a grain indemnity fund in Minnesota. The provisions in the jurisdiction of this judicial committee are Section 1 through 4, grain contracts, and then Section 6, Subdivision 6, 7, 9, and 12. After many years of grain elder collapse, we have finally meaningful protection for the producers of grain sellers in Minnesota. When farmers sell grain in elevators, they often don't collect payments right away. And in fact, they're extending credit to the elevators. In farming, you work all year to market your crop. And once you do, you have to pay your inputs and invest in the upcoming year. Not getting paid for delivered grain puts farmers in an incredibly difficult position. The indemnity fund proposed under my bill would protect producers. And while payments would be scaled based on how long farmers leave grain at the elevator, it would offer far more protection on cents on the dollars afforded under the current system. Why should we protect and have such program specific to grain elevators? The big reason is that we need it is needed because, much like bank, grain elevators hold community wealth. When they go under, they aren't just consequences for business, but all those farms entrusted them with their grain. Finally, just a couple important details on a proposal before I turn it over to my testifiers. The long-term funding mechanism for the fund is a premium assessed on sold grain. Those will be assessed in years when the fund dips below $9 million until the fund caps out at $15 million. It would be capped at an absolute maximum $20 on every $10,000 of market grain, but they would likely be much lower. Last session, to build the fund up to $15 million from $5 million on department estimate, they'll need assessment of $7 on every $10,000 on market grain. Secondly, and related, there are protections in the bill ensure that once the Department of Agriculture pays out the farmers, they'll be able to act as a party to the bankruptcy to work to recoup money on behalf of the state. There are also civil penalties for elevators who do not comply with this law. This is a good bill. And we're not going to figure this out on our own. In fact, we're following 14 other states, and it's time for Minnesota to catch up and protect its producers and families. I want to thank my co-authors on this committee, Representative Luke Frederick, and I'm proud to note that this bill enjoys bipartisan support. And with that, I'll turn over to my testifier from the Minnesota Farmers Union, Stu.
All right, I've got Stu Laurie. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stu Laurie. I'm the Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union, and I'm proud to share our organization's strongest support for Representative Cha's HF 2718. Our members care deeply about this proposal because since 2015, Nearly year over year, they've been caught up in bankruptcies. Most recently, the pipeline elevator failure in 2021, and then Global Food Processing when they went under in 2022. Some small organic producers in our membership were hit twice by those two elevators, and it was financially devastating for those families. Our current system is failing them, and the department will attest that farmers have gone bankrupt while waiting for payouts from the bonds. Now to a couple details that Representative Cha mentioned in the bill that might be of interest to this committee. First, as he said, the long-term funding mechanism is premiums assessed on sold grain. Under Representative Cha's bill, after paying out to producers, the Department of Agriculture in the state would be empowered to go after repayment to the fund as a party to bankruptcies. We think that's fair. It'll help protect the fund. And practically, it makes a lot more sense than the current system where farmers are each contracting with their own attorney or signing up for a private entity that then is going after repayment as a party to that bankruptcy. Second, the bill references civil penalties for elevators for noncompliance. This is one of those policies that requires everyone to be in a level playing field. We think those are fair and they're important under Subdivision 12. With that, I'll reiterate that these policies and others, MDA isn't reinventing the wheel. They belong to an association of grain regulatory officials. They've consulted with officials in those other 14 states that have indemnity funds and taken the best practices from those states. They're confident that they'll be able to implement this proposal. It's a good one. It's hugely important to us, and I hope it earns your support. So thank you so much for your work on it, Representative Chan, Representative Frederick, and thank you for the time today.
All right, thank you. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. All right, Representative Carroll.
Thank you. Just a little background in terms of the legal obligations of the grain. Why wouldn't the farmer just bring an action for replevin to recover the grain? So it really gets at whose grain is it when it's in the elevator? Is it still the farmer's, or is it the grain elevator?
Mr. Lurie.
Happy to answer that question. So basically, as a rule in the grain industry, farmers extend credit to that elevator. So sometimes you're right. If the bankruptcy happens, you know, the day after they deliver the grain is there in the elevator, and they can recoup that, right? That's a positive situation. There are still unfortunate stories where it takes a while for those court proceedings and the market can shift in which farmers lose a lot of money. But if they get their grain back, that's a positive situation. Oftentimes the grain is gone. It's already been marketed. In the case of Pipeline Foods, they were actually pursuing and hounding farmers in order to deliver grain up until they declared bankruptcy in Delaware in order to pay their other debts, and they were selling that grain, right? So it's gone, and the farmers couldn't recoup that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Scott.
Yeah, just to comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cha, are you going to be the new grain guy?
Representative Cha.
In fact, I am, because I have over 10 years experience of actually raising heifers and steers and doing 80 acres of hay. And I do ride quarter horses, train them, and I've been a farmer for a very long time.
Well, yeah, I bet the members of this committee maybe might not have known that a Representative Cha is the real deal.
Well,
Representative Scott.
This is fascinating to me. Thank you for standing up for farmers. I hope that the rest of your caucus will continue to, in that vein, to stand up for our farmers and all the problems that they're facing and the issues, regulations, that sort of thing that they're facing. So thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Cha. I just got one quick question here. The ones that you're talking about going bankrupt and not paying the farmers, they were large private corporations. In Minnesota, we have a lot of cooperatives where it's member-owned, where they sell the grain to their own cooperative, who turns around and pays them, then turns around and, as a group, sell the grain that's stored there to where the best profit for their local community. A lot of farmers do that because they don't have the storage facilities on their own property. Now, is this going to affect the cooperatives as well, or is it just the independents? Because cooperatives are member-owned and the members-driven. The members make the best plans for their grain. So is this going to take dollars away from the farmers that go to the cooperatives?
Representative Chaw.
Thank you for the question, Representative. I'm going to turn that over to Stu as he represents over 6,000 farmers in this.
Mr. Lurie.
Thank you, Representative Chaw, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for the question, and Chair Becker Finn. All grain buyers licensed in the state of Minnesota, including cooperatives, would be covered under this bill, and farmers who sell to cooperatives would be protected. I'm going to look over at the Department of Agriculture to confirm my statements here, but in the last number of years, since 2015, we've had a number of cooperatives go under and have those same stories. You know, I think of Carlstead, I think in was that, I don't remember the year, but you know, they went under, the manager got a brain tumor, couldn't manage the finances. Ashby is very high profile. There was fraud in that case, and the elevator manager is currently in prison. Both of those were cooperatives, and we heard some really difficult stories from farmers who were affected by those losses. And so we want to make sure that everyone across the state is protected by this, and it would be subject to all licensed grain buyers in the state.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Chaw.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, and thank you, Representative Peggy Scott, for that comment. You know, one of my priorities at this legislation is to protect all Minnesotans, especially greater Minnesota farmers across the state, as you know, that we have a shortage of farmers and young farmers. And so that would be a priority as I am sitting on the Agriculture Committee. Thanks for hearing HF 2718. And I want to thank all the partners and stakeholders involved, including Lead Anderson and my colleagues across the aisle. And I ask for support for the bill. Thank you.
All right. I will renew my motion to recommend that House Bill 2718 be re-referred to the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right. Representative Egbadje. I will move to recommend that House File 917 be placed on the General Register. I understand you have an A3 amendment. Would you like me to move the A3?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. I will move the A3 amendment. Could you just tell us briefly what the A3 amendment does?
Yes. Madam Chair and committee members, the A3 amendment clarifies some waiver language in the move-in, move-out inspections. It makes loss of a rental license or condemnation of a property an allowable instance to petition for emergency tenant remedies action. There's also some technical amendments throughout Article 4, and then expanding the sources of emergency rental assistance that will essentially make the 14-day notice act as a notice for emergency funding. So that's the essence of the A3 amendment.
All right. All those in favor of the A3, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Egbadje, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. Today I'm here to present House File 917. This bill is a package of important tenants' rights housing measures. The importance of this bill is to address the needs that have beleaguered tenants for many years in Minnesota. Renters make up 30% of households in Minnesota and in our most populous cities. Renters are close to or even more than 50% of all the households. Renting, especially for those who are low or middle income, can sometimes be a precarious way to live if your landlord is one that is absent, doesn't follow through with their end of the bargain, or does not have the skills to be a landlord. Similarly, if you end up in court because of a dispute, the landlord is often at the advantage over the tenant, and the tenant is limited in how they can hold landlords accountable. This bill package addresses that by spelling out a tenant's rights and the rights of the landlord in certain situations. It also outlines the best practices that many of our landlords are already implementing with their tenants. Overall, this bill seeks to balance the power dynamics between landlords and renters. Some of the bill provisions include prohibiting discrimination based on the use of public assistance. It also includes much needed reforms in the eviction court process to better ensure that tenants have a clear understanding of the allegations against them and where they can receive help. tenants would no longer need to pay the court to be able to hear their counterclaims and defenses. The package also includes a 14-day eviction notice so that tenants and landlords have time to negotiate or mediate before things escalate to the courtroom. The bill deals with expungements of eviction records so that tenants can more readily move on after an eviction. And finally, the bill keeps court records non-public until there has been a final judgment. With that, I'll turn it over to House Speaker to describe the bill further and walk through any more technical issues.
Ms. Davis.
Thanks, Chair and members. Mary Davis from the House Research Department. I'm going to start with Article 1 on page 1. It relates to tenants' rights. Sections 1 and 2 prohibit discrimination in housing against an individual who's receiving public assistance, and Section 3 provides a definition for the term public assistance in the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Section 4 provides exemptions to Sections 1 through 3. Section 5 provides that when any kind of animal is allowed on a rental property, the landlord cannot advertise or prevent the or require the renter to declaw or devocalize their pets, and it also imposes penalties. Section 6 requires the landlord to disclose fees that are not related to a service provided by the landlord, including requiring the landlord to include those fees in the total monthly cost for rent and include it on the cover of the lease or in any advertisements, and also provides a penalty. Section 7 and 8 require a landlord to offer an initial inspection of a unit to identify defects and a move-out inspection to have the landlord give the tenant a written notice about the right to do the walkthrough of the unit and also do a walkthrough of the unit, and it provides for damages. Sections 9 and 10 restrict a landlord's entry into a residential unit between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. and clarifies that the notice needs to be 24 hours before entry, and also updates existing penalties in that area. Section 11 requires the court to appoint counsel to represent a defendant in a housing eviction case when the defendant is a resident of public housing. It also provides qualifications for those attorneys and compensation requirements for appointments in those cases. Article 2 starts on page 8 and relates to lease covenants and repairs in residential tenancy. Section 1 requires a landlord to provide heat in a residential tenancy at a minimum temperature of 68 degrees. Section 2 allows cases when a tenant's been locked out to be brought for the same filing fee as they would in conciliation court. Section 4 specifies the type of incidents that allow a tenant to petition for emergency repair in a residential unit, Section 3 and 4, and allows the tenant to petition for that emergency relief in an ex parte petition and for the court to order that relief. Article 3 starts on page 12 and relates to lease terminations. So Section 1 removes a provision that allows a landlord to terminate a tenancy without a written lease with 14 days notice. Section 2 requires a landlord in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and Duluth to wait until 6 months before the end of a lease, but not sooner, to ask a tenant if they'd like to renew their lease and stay in the unit if the lease is for more than 10 months. Section 3 allows a tenant to terminate a lease if the tenant requires assistance with daily living, meaning nursing facility care, or has a disability related to mental illness, and they're moving to a facility for those reasons. This section requires the tenant to provide notice to the landlord 2 months in advance, along with medical documentation and proof that the tenant is moving out. Article 4 starts on page 14 and makes process modifications to residential evictions. Section 1 changes the procedure when an eviction alleges material lease violation and rent owed in an eviction. Section 2 alters existing procedures in eviction actions for non-payment of rent, including allowing a government agency to assist with redemption of the unit. Section 3 provides a new procedure for the summons in an eviction case. It also provides that expedited evictions should only proceed in an expedited matter if there's a threat of ongoing violation of unlawful or dangerous activities. And it allows the court to dismiss an expungement eviction that doesn't follow the procedures for summons and complaint. Section 4 expands options for notifying tenants of an eviction action when the tenant cannot be found, including using cell phone, texts, and emails. Section 5 prevents a bond from being posted for a tenant except when the case is being appealed. Section 6 allows the court to issue an expungement when the tenant prevails in an eviction action. Section 7 allows a party to bring a motion to vacate a judgment in an eviction action for situations where the judgment was entered as a result of a mistake, fraud, or misconduct. Section 8 provides a new requirement for the summons. Section 9 clarifies what the court can require in an appeals case for a bond. Section 10 requires a stay for all appeals. Section 11 requires is just technical and conforming changes. Section 12 amends an exception for certain actions and appeals proceedings. And Section 13 provides the effective dates for all of the sections in Article 4 is August 1, 2023. Article 5 starts on page 23, and it relates to eviction records. Section 1 amends the procedure and review required in a case for discretionary expungement. Section 2 adds additional situations where an eviction action must be expunged by the court. And Section 3 requires the court to keep eviction case filings confidential until after the case has been decided. And that is all of the DE.
All right, thank you. Representative Agbaji, would you like us to move on to your testifiers?
Yes, Manager.
All right, I've got Rachel Sterling and Elizabeth Glidden. You can both come up. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Rachel Sterling, and I am a housing attorney at Homeline. Chair Beckerfin and members of the committee, we come here today in support of House File 917 as it offers many long overdue updates in Minnesota's tenant landlord law. In working with thousands of tenants across Minnesota over the last 30 years, we know that a consistent universal pre-eviction notice is sorely needed so tenants have an opportunity to fix problems, negotiate agreements with their landlords, or just quit the lease and vacate the apartment. Outcomes which make filing an eviction unnecessary, reduce the amount of cases brought to the court, and reduce the cost to landlords. I talk to tenants every day who do not know that their landlord had filed an eviction until they got a letter from Homeline's Eviction Prevention Project. Our letter is the reason that they had time to apply for emergency assistance, to try and address the issues, to plan their next steps. Unfortunately for these tenants, our letter comes too late for them to avoid having an eviction on their record. The pre-eviction notice is proposed in House File 917 also mirrors the required procedure already in place for when a landlord is in breach of a lease and the tenant is requesting that they make the required repairs or such. So this required communication is reciprocal in order to keep resolvable issues out of our court systems. Evictions impact a lot of people across the state. So for example, there were between 18 and 22,000 evictions filed in 2022 in Minnesota. That means at least 18,000 households that had an eviction on their public record the moment that eviction was filed, who faced being forced out of their homes, that had to struggle to maintain and find quality, affordable housing where they felt safe and secure. Most landlords do not rent to someone who has an eviction on their record. And those that do all too often offer substandard housing that tenants are forced to take because their options are either that or homelessness. Evictions have a long-lasting and deeply negative impact on a tenant's ability to get safe and or adequate housing, but the expungement reforms proposed in House File 917 will go a long way to mitigating the harm that an eviction can do to a tenant's future. For those cases where the tenant prevailed, the case was dismissed or settled, or where the eviction is no longer a reasonable indicator of a tenant's future behavior. The bill also updates when landlords can enter tenants' homes by giving a clear 24-hour notice requirement instead of the subjective reasonable notice required under the current law. Tenants pay for and deserve to be able to expect privacy in their own homes. I know I would be terrified and outraged if someone unexpectedly walked into my home while I was in the shower, even if it was a friend who I gave a key to. Yet, I have spoken to numerous tenants who have had that exact experience. They tell me they feel violated, they feel unsafe in their homes, and are always, always frustrated by the meaningless remedies that they have under the current law. House Bill 917 gives tenants a way to restore some of their dignity, to hold their erring landlords accountable, and hopefully will prevent these intrusions from happening in the first place. The proposed source of income protections will offer stability and flexibility to renter households across Minnesota. Minnesota renters should not be discriminated against based on their source of income they receive. As is the case in a number of other states, housing subsidies such as Section 8 or Bridges vouchers, which is a state-level program, would assist tenants in paying their rent and should not be the reason a landlord could discriminate against them. This bill offers clarity to both landlords and tenants and gives tenants some of the long overdue basic protections they need and deserve. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Director Glidden, if you can introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you to the chair and the committee. My name is Elizabeth Glidden, and I'm the deputy director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership, which is a 30-plus year nonprofit providing public policy, research, and community development services across the state and beyond. And I'm testifying in support of House File 917, specifically those provisions prohibiting rental discrimination based on participation in a public assistance program. All tenants deserve fair and equal access to housing, and that access shouldn't differ based on the source of revenue used to pay the rent, whether that source is alimony or disability benefits or through a public assistance program like rental assistance. Rental assistance is a best practice for supporting families across the state working to make ends meet. And our biggest rental assistance program within the state of Minnesota is actually federal housing choice vouchers. But three out of every four households eligible for those vouchers or Section 8 never receive one. There aren't enough. Eligible households wait years to receive a housing choice voucher, but even after that wait, around 40% or even more aren't able to place that voucher because they can't find a landlord to accept one. And if they can't find a unit within a prescribed time, they have to return that voucher or lose it, and it goes to another household to try. When landlords refuse to rent to those with Section 8 without consideration of that renter's individual merits, this perpetuates housing instability and inefficient use of public resources. Source of income protections will not impede a landlord's ability to determine in a non-discriminatory manner the ability of the applicant to rent the property. It doesn't limit the landlord's ability to set rents at the rate that they determine or use screening criteria of their choice. Source of income protections are tested because they have been utilized in states or adopted in states and cities across the country, and they work. We know that from lots of research on these programs that have been placed for decades in other locations that vouchers are utilized at greater rates, households have greater success in using their vouchers, and that there's increased choice such that households can live in communities of their choice, and landlords receive guaranteed income. Landlords have chosen a business that affects the health, safety, and well-being of Minnesota families. It's a business regulated to ensure state and local standards for health and safety and other conditions are met. Ensuring fair consideration of renters regardless of their source of income is reasonable and is a Minnesota value that should be clarified as we recommend in these amendments to the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. I also have Stephanie Saji signed up to testify. And then I have Cecil Smith on deck. Good morning. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Chair Becker-Finn, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Saji, and I am a mother, a survivor, a landlord, and I am also the working with Violence Free Minnesota as the Housing and Economic Justice Program Policy Manager. So Violence Free Minnesota is a statewide coalition. We have over 80 member programs that provide advocacy and services to domestic violence victims and survivors. Our member programs work with survivors throughout all of Minnesota's 87 counties to address homelessness and housing instability through an array of supports, including emergency shelter, housing programming, homelessness prevention resources, legal advocacy, and housing navigation services. I'm here today on behalf of VFMN's member programs and the victim survivors they serve in support of HF 917. The interconnectedness between domestic violence and homelessness is staggering. Domestic violence has been identified as one of the top five reasons people experience homelessness in Minnesota. VFMN recently conducted a survey with member programs, and when asked which aspects of the tenant screening process create the most barriers for survivors, 48% of respondents included source of income discrimination. HF 917 would prohibit this harmful practice. Source of income discrimination heavily exacerbates the often insurmountable hurdles that survivors face in finding safe housing, which is the foundation of healing and stabilizing their life and the lives of their children. These barriers prevent survivors from fleeing abuse and lead to homelessness. We urge you to pass HF 917 and with it create increased safety and stability for survivors and their families so that the policies in place are no longer contributing to the harm. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Cecil Smith. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cecil Smith. I'm the President and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. We represent 2,200 members who serve 600,000 renters who make their home in more than 300,000 rental homes provided by our members. The inclusion of the mandatory Section 8 is a serious concern for several reasons, but especially because the proposal would make non-participation a discriminatory practice. This proposal takes away from a provider's current option to voluntarily participate in this program and forces the housing provider to enter into a housing assistance payment contract, known as the HAP contract, with the federal government administered by a local housing authority. We're also still concerned about other included provisions in the bill which have not had language changes to meet the threshold of a functional statute. Those other provisions include expungement of almost all eviction records, minimum heat, and ETRA expansion. We hope we can still work on those elements. We also believe the 14-day notice requirement for an eviction will make Minnesota an outlier. The majority of the changes to the law have an effective date of August 1st, which is unworkable. We have over 28,000 employees in our industry, and we need time to understand the law, develop training programs for our staff, and implement business processes in compliance with the law. We suggest an August 1st, 2024 as an effective date. This bill is not alone in creating a disincentive to investment in Minnesota, and long term will only serve to reduce the vital supply of housing and increase the cost of housing. We need a balanced approach that serves to attract capital to create housing and protects our customers from predatory practices by unethical operators. I urge a no vote.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and Representative Agbaje. I just want to thank you for this bill. As a renter, as a person who has rented for many years and will very likely continue to do so, this is the kind of bill that we can pass and just immediately benefit so many people who need help. It's a great bill. It's exactly what we should be doing. The powerlessness of being a renter fighting against a landlord when you know you're right but you have no recourse is one of the most maddening and difficult things a person can do, trying to secure their housing. I have faced that situation, and it's the dehumanizing feeling of fighting for housing against a force that you have no power to fight is wrong. So I just wanted to express my gratitude and urge a support for this bill.
All right. Next, I have Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Representative Abadje, I've read over the multi-housing folks, their concerns, and full disclosure, my husband and I are housing providers. It's a very small scale, but we do provide housing for folks. And one of the concerns that I have with requiring housing providers to take someone that is receiving public assistance, particularly Section 8, is it was built to be a voluntary program. And now, and one of the reasons that there's some reluctance is there have been situations where housing providers enter into these contracts for Section 8, and then what happens is there's no guarantee of that income. The public housing authority
can fail to pay the agreed upon amount, and there's nothing that the housing provider can do. They can't go back to the tenant, and if there's no money in that public housing authority's bank account, there's the landlord is left hanging high and dry. So could you address the fairness of that for me?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Thank you, Representative Scott, for the question. So yes, the public assistance program is seen as guaranteed income from whichever entity is coming from to pay that portion of the rent. We have heard this concern multiple times over, but the only example that we had heard was that twice in the course of 10 years, an account in Ramsey County had not been paid. But overall, we have not been seeing multiple times where the federal government has not paid their portion of the rent. I believe the federal government continues to work to try to make sure that the vouchers that they have out there, that they are able to pay them, but they may not be increasing the vouchers because they know that they may not be able to pay for increased vouchers.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair and Representative Agbaje, will the agreements that a housing provider enter into on Section 8 explicitly says the owner may not terminate the tenancy for non-payment of PHA housing assistance programs. So the landlord is stuck. Now, maybe there's one instance of that happening now, but as you know, we're on a very, economically speaking in this country, we're on a very thin line that we're walking right now. The federal government and now the state government seem to be spending money like drunken sailors, and someday the chickens are going to come home to roost, and then housing providers are going to be left high and dry. I could go into other issues with why housing providers may or may not take public assistance, but that is primary of one of them, is because they have their own lease agreements that they traditionally set up between themselves and their tenants have no meaning when you go to Section 8. So it's a total reversal. You know, Representative Finke said it's a power imbalance of some sort. These are contracts that people enter into normally, you know, with no one's forcing them to enter into the contracts on either side, but two willing parties come together and enter into a contract. But under Section 8, there is no balance. Whoever is paying the housing provider has all the power. So I had some other issues with the bill. Let's see. The language around these emergencies, emergency expansion of emergency tenant remedy actions, and
Representative Scott, could you point to the page or the section just so we can?
I don't have it right here, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Maybe House Research can help with that. But one of the issues I have is that on the infestation piece, is there anything in this bill that speaks to the liability there? What if a tenant brings that infestation with them when they move in, and then they turn around and tell the landlord, you know, that they're applying for this emergency tenant action remedy? What's the landlord's recourse?
Representative Agbaje, that was a lot to respond to, but please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll start with the emergency tenant remedies piece first. So in that process, there's usually some notification of whatever the issue is that the tenant has and some time for the landlord to respond. It's usually when, in the cases when the landlord hasn't responded, that the issue needs to be taken care of and they can do this petition. There's a lot of issues in sometimes older buildings or a building where
you know, maybe the landlord just hasn't upkept the property in an appropriate way. So this just provides a way for tenants to be able, if they're not getting the appropriate response they need, or if this is something that is, you know, an emergency on the day of, that they have a manner of recourse to do that. I will just say on the piece about source of income, you know, I think it's really important that we kind of keep in mind that landlords are being active in a public space. They are actively and publicly offering a unit of housing. And so when you are operating in a public space, there are a number of rules and regulations that you have to follow. Some could say that those rules and regulations are voluntary because they've decided to become a landlord, but part of that is not being able to discriminate against people if you are offering something that they can buy in the public market. And so with this, I think we should just continue to ground ourselves in the fact that there are people who need housing. There are many different ways that they get their income. And the way, if you are receiving income from some type of public assistance, that should not make you less worthy of receiving housing.
All right. Any follow-up, Representative Scott?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure I heard an answer to my question on the remedy portion for the emergency. It seems like for the emergency tenant remedy action, it seems like that's a 24-hour window. And if you've got an infestation, if you've got even a broken refrigerator, we run into the issue right now because there's so few people. We have such a struggle with workforce issues right now that even to get somebody to come and fix a broken refrigerator may take days. And so it's not allowing a lot of flexibility. And like with an issue of an infestation, that may take weeks to remedy. And in the meantime, it just seems like, you know, the housing provider is being punished for something that's out of their control. I also wanted to address the issue of automatic expungement and this, I think it's in this bill too, where that it's not reported publicly that an unlawful detainer or an eviction proceeding is made public until the court proceeding has happened. And we've experienced in our time in owning rental property over the last 20 years where someone will play the system, right? They'll know ahead of time that they're going to be evicted because they're not paying or they're breaking the lease in some other way. So they'll hustle real quick and they'll go to the next landlord before something becomes public. And the only way the other landlord is going to know that might be happening is if in their background check, they're finding out from the courts that a proceeding has been filed. So your, and it kind of goes with the expungement piece too. It's really important for housing providers to know for the safety of all of the tenants in their building, especially if it's a multi-housing building, more than one unit. They really need to know if someone has an unlawfully detained, or if they've been evicted in the past, because that will tell them what the future might hold. And there may be situations where it may not necessarily be for non-payment of rent, it may be for something else that's illegal activity, so or putting other tenants in danger. So I think that it's not fair to the other people that may live in the building for the landlord not to have those resources to make sure that the people that they're getting to live in their buildings are safe and capable of upholding the lease. So I don't know, that was a lot, but I don't know if you have any comments on that.
Got sailors, chickens, all kinds of stuff. Representative Egbadje, any comment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. I was able to follow. I will have my testifier kind of explain a little bit more on the ETRA. As they have more direct experience with that. And then I'll come back and talk about the expungement.
All right. Rachel Sterling, go ahead.
Rachel Sterling, thank you. Just for quick, Representative Scott, Madam Chair, you had talked about what recourse the landlord had if, say, the tenant was responsible for
the infestation is what you were talking about. So Minnesota law already allows that if the landlord can show that the tenant is the cause of the damage or problem through either their willful, malicious, or irresponsible conduct, then the landlord is not responsible for that. And then you talked about pipeline supply issues and things like that. What the language says is that it has to immediately begin on line 11.14. That doesn't mean immediately complete.
Right. Follow up, Representative Scott, and then I've got Representative Johnson. We got one more bill
just
today.
One follow up and comment on what the testifier just spoke of. You stated that there's already something in law. If in this example, if the infestation was the responsibility, it came from the tenant. If that's a Section 8 under this contract, then who would the landlord go back to be made whole for the treating of the infestation?
Representative Agbaje, or?
That's my understanding of the Section 8 program is they're only responsible for the providing the rent, and so that would be the tenant's responsibility to deal with. If the landlord can show that it was through the tenant's irresponsible, malicious, or willful conduct.
Representative Scott.
So if a person is of low income, the landlord will never be made whole. We've had situations like this in our past, and we've never been made whole ever for damage caused by somebody that, is on public assistance. Now, we have recovered from people that aren't, but it's a risk sometimes, right, for a housing provider. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Badge. I understand what you're trying to do here. Unfortunately, it goes a little too far. Trying to balance things, balance the scale, make things even. This goes way beyond that. One deal is with the eviction issue. Currently, there's some places that require the notice ahead before eviction process starts. And that does work. That takes care of some of it. Excuse me. The problem is just delays. And now, in this bill, you have to give the letter. They have 14 days before to either move out or pay the rent. They do neither. But you're usually 3 to 5 days before that letter is sent. Give them time to pay their rent. Then if you also change the 7 day for court to 14 days. We are now at a month without the housing provider getting any income to pay for the, if it's a home and not a rental unit, say in an apartment building. He's a month without paying some of the bills he has to pay for that, including it might even be a mortgage. I've served the first round of eviction papers. And in that round, you give the notice. You have 14 days. It went from 7 and you have 14 days. They go to court. The judge usually gives 30 days. Now you're 2 months without rent. And they don't move out. Guess what? You got to go back to court again. And this process lasts 2-3 more times before you get the notice where the sheriff can actually physically remove them. And by that time comes with this, you're now pushing 9, 10, 11 months with no income. If there's a mortgage on that property and it's a single family home, guess what? It's in foreclosure. The assets of that housing provider are gone. Overall, the eviction process we have now works very well. Because guess what? When eviction notice is filed, they have to be physically handed to the person. You have to service at night, in the evening, you have to serve it in the daytime before it can actually physically post it on the door of the apartment. And then they have 1 week to have that hearing. They can call and schedule it and make it happen, or if they don't call, that means they agree to move out. This is going to be hard on housing providers.
And just to be clear, for the public's benefit, we've been using it interchangeably, but I'm pretty sure housing provider, you're referring to landlords. The bill itself uses the word landlord, so I just want to make sure people have been moving back and forth between those two words, but just so we're clear on the record.
But you can call it landlord. I call it a housing provider because they are providing housing for individuals. They're using their assets to provide the housing. So there's a problem with the eviction problem. The other issue I have with this bill, and it's in the eviction process. The other day in the housing committee, we had a nonprofit that is a housing provider. And it might have been one of your bills, Representative at Badge. I can't remember, we've had so many. That the nonprofit needed, I think it was $10 million. Because of deferred maintenance required on the facilities. And I can't remember how many million dollars of assets that nonprofit had because of all the rental units they have. I think they had over 1,000 units. But this last year, they had a loss of revenue of $7 million from non-payment of rent. But now they want the state to make up that difference. And the bill was, and we talked about it, how privately owned, or how housing by privately owned individuals, not nonprofits, are going through the same thing. But they do not have the state taxpayer dollars making up the difference. The nonprofits do, but all the grants that we are giving them, taxpayer dollars making up the difference. I do have a feeling that this bill that you're presenting today is going to remove all privately owned housing for individuals that need rent. So private housing providers are going to be shut out of the state of Minnesota, and it's all going to be run by nonprofits. And if rent is not paid and maintenance is due, it's going to be the taxpayers' dollars. With that, I cannot support this bill. There's just too many issues with it.
Representative Frazier, Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Baje, for bringing this bill. You know, I don't know how many folks in here, but I am a survivor of two evictions from multifamily housing. And in each one of those cases, these protections didn't exist, or my family would not have been evicted if that was the situation. We would have been able to provide the resources that were needed to keep us in those places. And we did struggle to find housing quickly after that. So I know that feeling. I have that experience, and I don't want anyone to have to experience that. You know, oftentimes when there is such a power imbalance, when you start to change that imbalance to those that have had that power, it feels like an injustice. And I think in this situation, there will be a bit of pain as we adjust to this new way of doing things. But it is providing a balance for many of the folks that are renters, which is becoming increasingly a large part of the people that live in this state and other states, because the fact of the matter is single-family housing is becoming out of reach for many folks. I mean, that goes to a lot of the things that we have to deal with in our society. And I know you're not trying to correct all those things, but you are providing a balance and you're providing some protections for a large majority of the population of what is affordable for people to have shelter in their communities, which is a big positive impact on communities for in terms of stabilization and all kinds of positive outcomes when you have that stable shelter. So thank you for bringing this bill, and I'm looking forward to supporting it.
Closing comments, Representative Egbadje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for the lively discussion today. I really appreciate all of the comments. I will just close by saying, you know, the changes presented here are the culmination of hours of work between varied bill authors and stakeholders, including those who are supportive and those who still have concerns. And, you know, as we continue to work on this, there are a number of things that, you know, with deadlines happening, we still have to add into the bill. And I think some of the people with concerns will be happy to see some of those changes. But overall, I just really want to continue to ground us in the fact that, you know, housing really should be a human right. And part of the ways that we get to doing that is ensuring that when there are disputes, there are opportunities to take a beat, calm down, allow folks to come together, find a mediation, find a reasonable resolution. So that way both the landlord can get paid and the renter has a place to live. And at the end of the day, most of our landlords are already doing what they're supposed to do. And the only way you get wrapped up in this is if somehow something breaks down. And that's what we legislate for, when things break down. So look forward to the committee support, and thank you so much for the time today.
All right. I will renew my motion to recommend that House File 917 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Representative Bliss. I will move to recommend that House File 665 be placed on the general register. Welcome to the committee. Representative Bliss, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope you've all had time to read my lengthy bill. It's very, very complicated. Basically, a few years back, we found some lenders that were taking advantage of veterans and their widows with some pretty bad loans. And with the help from legal here, we created a bill that took care of that issue. Unfortunately, there was we should change one word from an or to an and to encompass everything. And my testifier is going to clarify things a little bit more than I did. Thank you.
All right. Welcome, Mr. Elwood. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I want to thank Representative Bliss, first of all, for his underlying bill that passed in 2018, which he brought to protect service members, veterans, and their families from predatory lending practices. This is obviously a pretty simple bill regarding the remedies in case the violation of that law took place. The intent was always to have both monetary or legal relief and equitable relief, and unfortunately, somehow in the sausage making, the and became an or, and we want to just switch it back, and it's as simple as that.
All right. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this word? Member discussion. All right. Representative Weens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief and I'll be brilliant. On this, well, maybe we'll have a vote on that.
Setting the bar pretty high, Representative Weens.
Yeah, well, I'll be brief. How's that? 50%. I think this is a bipartisan thing. And Representative Bliss, Mr. Elwood, thank you for bringing this up. And it's funny how just one word can make a big difference. I've got sort of a two-part question. One is, do we know how many veterans family of veterans that were affected by this? And then the second half, probably for Mr. Elwood, is on the two-sided piece, the equity piece and the monetary gain, how many would be fixed by the passage of this particular bill? And thank you.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Weens, this is really kind of a proactive measure. We don't really know. I mean, in 2018, there was enough smoke that there was a fire was brewing, and that's why Representative Bliss came forward and protected these victims. We haven't really had any particular cases. We're not necessarily aware of them. But, of course, as you well know, oftentimes people don't come forward, and they don't know, and they don't know what their rights are in the first place. So, you know, this is really just making sure that, you know, if and when this happens, veterans, service members, and their families have all the tools that are available under law to give them the proper protections that they need.
Any follow-up, Representative Weems?
Madam Chair, if I could.
Oh, Representative Bliss.
Back when we were doing the research on this bill, there were several examples in other states that were happening, and we saw the same types of activity happening here in Minnesota. That's why we took the, not necessarily that we could charge anyone at the time, but we saw what was happening in other states. We saw it coming here, so we took the preemptive. So I don't know if we've ever had any here in Minnesota.
Representative Weems.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for taking a circumspective look at this and then doing the prophylactics to make certain that we get this right for our Minnesota veterans and their families. Thank you very much.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Bliss.
Thank you, and I appreciate your support.
All right. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 665 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Just a reminder, we do have one more extra committee meeting this week, tomorrow, before we hit second deadline. So with that, we are adjourned.